Hello there, and welcome to The Delicious Dish. This is Radio Free Nintendo episode 177. I'm back, your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, the indomitable Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And John Lindemann is back.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, he took a little vacation along with me. And James couldn't be on. We were actually recording a little earlier, so he's still at work, poor guy. But we do have a wonderful guest, and the we'll go with co-host for now of the NWR newscast, Andy Gergen.
Greetings, everyone.
Welcome, sir.
Yeah, co-host is about right. Me and Neil kind of split it.
Yeah, all right. Well, there aren't enough episodes to establish standard yet. So you're still working.
We've only had about three in a row with the same cast on it.
So, we're going to have new business today, and then we'll get into some listener mail. First, I want to wish everyone a happy new year. It should be in the year 2010 by the time you hear this. So, welcome to a new era in Nintendo stuff, I guess. Probably not. Probably be the same.
Probably just kind of weird and awkward like this intro.
Yeah, I know. And I know. I'm on vacay and
see, this is the thing is what's cool about this is that we're actually getting a view into Johnny's mind of what happens to him when he goes to fish concerts night after night after night. Usually typically he takes like a couple of weeks off to go to like whatever festival he goes to.
Yeah. I guess I'll get into my current situation a little bit later.
Believe me, it is a situation.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I do want to say, in all seriousness, thanks to Greg and James and 2IP for holding down the fort last week. I just finally got a chance to listen to it this morning and loved it. Thought it was fantastic. I'm actually glad that there were only three people on it because...
You're glad?
Yeah.
When you've got Boxing Day to edit it, you need all the help you can get.
And man.
Three audio streams.
Yeah, wow. I thought you beneficial. Had plenty of time. That feature discussion was so far-reaching, you know, and wide-ranging that I think it would have just been a bit of a mess with four or five voices on it. So it actually, I felt like kind of three was almost the perfect number to cover as many topics and facets of that discussion as you guys did. And you did a wonderful job, so really appreciated it. All right, we're going to get started, and Andy, being the guest this week, you're first, man, with new business.
Excellent. Well, one of the previous episodes where I was on Radio for Nintendo, I mentioned that I was playing through the Zelda games. At that time, I was playing through Oracle of Seasons, and slowly, I have since finished Oracle of Seasons, and I am moving on to Majora's Mask, which I am about 90% of the way through now, I think. I just finished the fourth of four dungeons, but I still have a lot of side quests to go, which is pretty much the bulk of Majora's Mask, really. And God, I'm loving this game. You know, I thought when I played this game back in 99, or I guess 2000, 2001, I thought then that it was my favorite Zelda game of all time, and I haven't really gone back to it since then. And I really didn't think that would hold up, having played, you know, Wind Waker and Twilight Princess and the passage of time and whatnot. But having replayed it, you know, I think it still might be my favorite Zelda game of all time. This game is really, really solid. And I think I've made one fairly important discovery about my my gaming preferences while playing Majora's Mask, and that's that I actually much prefer 3D Zelda to 2D Zelda. I halfway through Oracle of Seasons, I was just really tired of it. And maybe that's just because I had just played through like three 2D Zeldas in a row, but even after my Zelda burnout from Oracle of Seasons, I still like put a lot of time into Majora's Mask in a fairly short period of time.
And where do you put Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks? Are those 2D or 3D for you?
I only played about half of Phantom Hourglass, and I haven't touched Spirit
2D.
Tracks yet. So it's really hard to say, but yeah, I think it's basically 2D.
Yeah.
I just really love the story progression in Majora's Mask. And it's not really story progression, but just like the world progression, the timeline thing. Having a definite 3-day time period allows them to do something that's never been done in a Zelda game before or since, and that's to have a sense of time. There's actually a physical timeline. No matter what you're doing in the game, you're always a part of that timeline, and things change depending on that timeline. And that's just it's just not something you've seen in other games, really. It's not something you've seen in any other Zelda games, that's for sure. And it's cool because it allows the other entities in the game to have nothing to do with you. even if you choose to interact with them later. Yeah, I love it. Absolutely loving this game.
It brings in a lot of time management, too, which is, I think, unique to Majora's Mask in terms of that series.
Yes and no. I know that a common complaint of Majora's Mask is the fact that you don't have, you know, as much time as you want to go through the dungeons and whatnot. And that's true. You do have to do it within the set time period.
I like that.
But if you play the song on your ocarina that slows down time, that's like 4 hours. That's like 3 or 4 hours you have to spend. So it's not really that big of a deal. Like as long as you save before you go to a temple, you're really not gonna be pushed that hard.
Yeah, I think it annoyed people who, you know, would do a lot of the things that led up to going into a dungeon. You know, a lot of the kind of preface stuff in a town or getting to the place and hitting the owl statue so you can warp back there quickly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when their 3-day cycle was already halfway over, they jump into the dungeon, and you're probably, even if you're slowed down, you may not be able to finish that dungeon when you've already only got a day and a half to do it. And certainly it ratchets up the pressure a lot. But the thing is, you don't really have to do that. I mean,
No. Once you get the song that opens a way to the dungeon, there's always a particular song, and once you get the song and or the warp point as well, that's your cue to save. And then come back with a full 3 days to work with, and then crack on with the dungeon. And usually I didn't find it impinged too much on my kind of dungeon exploring and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Andy, what did you think about the dungeons themselves relative to some of these other Zelda games? Because there are so few of them, it's quite different from other games. I mean, did you find the design different accordingly?
I seem to remember when I played the first time through thinking that they were bigger to compensate for the lack of them. Having now replayed them, I'm not so sure I agree with that. I think they're about on par with the other ones I've seen in Ocarina, especially like some of the bigger ones in Ocarina.
You probably just miss out that really small one at the start, like the Deku Tree or whatever. Like you don't have anything quite that sort of trivial.
I think Majora's Mask, I think the dungeons are more intricate. They may not be longer, but they tend to be, you know, it a lot of times there's kind of a, well, at least in 3 out of the 4, there's sort of a core puzzle going on in that dungeon that you solve it piecemeal as you go through the different floors and the different rooms. And you kind of have to keep an eye on what's going on and how the whole dungeon fits together. Whereas in Ocarina of Time, a lot of times you're just kind of solving the dungeon one room at a time.
Once you
solve that room, you move on to the next one, and you don't really have to think about it as much. Whereas in Majora's Mask, they do all really wrap together in kind of a spiral fashion. And the best example of that is the Great Bay Temple, which is my favorite Zelda temple ever. And a lot of people don't like it. I mean, I understand why people don't like it, because you do have to... It's complicated, and you have to keep up with it. You have to really learn how it all fits together and what's going on with that. But, you know, as this weird, almost engineering kind of puzzle, I mean, it's... I think it's perfect. I think it's brilliant.
Well, it's kind of neat, because you play through Ocarina, and you get to the water temple, and you groan your way through the entire thing, because you're constantly, you know, switching to your inventory or whatnot. You know, the water temple is one of those things that's sort of infamous in Zelda games as frustrating rather than rewarding. So you get to the, you know, you finish that game and you go to the next one and you go on to Majora's Mask and you get to the water temple there, and immediately you're dreading it because you just had this awful experience with the water temple in Ocarina and you're like, oh God. But you go in there and man, it's great. You're right. That probably is one of the best temples in any Zelda game. And it's not, you know, even though it involves a lot of swimming around, the Zora Mask makes swimming in Majora's Mask fun, which is kind of unheard of in a Zelda game, to be perfectly honest. it's awesome. And, you know, one other thing about the dungeons in Majora's Mask is you actually feel, because of the stray fairy element, that every dungeon has 15 stray fairies to get you a bonus power up after the dungeon's over. And because of that, not only do you solve the dungeon, but you own the dungeon. Like by the time you're done with that dungeon, you know everything about that dungeon. I think it's more rewarding, personally.
Well, we better move on, Andy. So what else have you been playing?
I got a copy of The Conduit in the mail waiting for me when I got back from my Christmas vacation. I put it in last night for the first time and played through about 30 to 40 minutes of it. I haven't got too far into it yet. this is a game that I have been kind of looking forward to for a while, but I hadn't really felt compelled to track it down. But it was on sale from Newegg for pretty cheap, so I picked it up. It's fun. It is exactly what everyone has said it was for a very long time. It's a decent to very good first-person shooter on a system that doesn't have any really particularly competent first-person shooters. Maybe, you know, the Call of Duty games accepted, I suppose. It really, when I played it, what really struck me was this is a game that's trying very, very hard to bring the experience of the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 games home to the Wii. Because immediately you've got achievements, and they're called achievements. Immediately it says achievement unlocked. Online multiplayer looks and feels just like it does on Xbox Live, assuming you're playing with strangers. I haven't played with anybody I know because I don't know anybody who wants to play. Maybe I'll figure that out later. But really, once you're in there, I mean, it really does just feel like a game of Halo on Xbox Live. Once you're actually in the game, like the gameplay of it, you know, you got 12 strangers running around a fairly decent map shooting each other with a couple different modes and a fair amount of people actually in the map. You know, it works pretty well. I didn't play online too much, but I played a couple of random matches for a little while, got tired of being shot and quit. But the single player mode was decent, pretty generic storyline about some sort of alien government cover up, whatever. I kind of skipped through most of that, or at least slept through it. I had two problems with the game, having played a little bit of it so far. And the first one is that AI is pretty much non-existent. Enemies run at you and you shoot them. The second problem I had was that basically it almost seems like it's kind of a shooting gallery setup. Like it's not an on-rails game, but you seem to go into an environment and then shoot a whole bunch of guys, and then move to the next environment and shoot a whole bunch of guys. It doesn't feel like a Half-Life, where you're kind of progressing through a carefully built structure. It feels like a series of slaughterhouse rooms. Mm-hmm. But the graphics are really impressive. Frame rate's good. The art style is not particularly great, but I mean it's serviceable, and it feels like a kind of experience that is not really otherwise available on the Wii. And that's kind of nice, because the Wii has a unique way of experiencing that type of game, and it's nice that experience is able to happen with that control scheme. It'd be a shame if we went through the entire lifespan of the Wii without one decent original shooter on a controller that seems to be, in a lot of ways, pretty ideal for the genre.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'd really like to see something like a true kind of AAA shooter, like something as good as, you know, Metroid Prime 3, except an actual first-person shooter. Because the thing is, with The Conduit, it strikes me as kind of a good first try from a company that really doesn't have much experience in creating, you know, first-person shooters, which was the case. But, you know, I would love to see a team that really, really knows what they're doing and has a lot of experience in first-person shooters create a first-person shooter for the Wii. But I don't know if that's going to happen, unfortunately.
You know, even Treyarch, I mean, in all seriousness, I know people shit on Treyarch because they make the off-brand Call of Duties or whatever, but they are a good developer. And, you know, even a game like Call of Duty World at War is a very good game and sold a shit ton of copies.
Yeah.
And obviously they've made some pretty good versions for Wii, but I would love to see Treyarch kind of split off a team, and they have plenty of Wii developers at that studio. I'd love to see them split off a team and make a first-person shooter exclusively for Wii and just really tailor it to what the system can do. And and as Greg said last week, put some things in there that really only make sense when you're using a Wii kind of a control scheme, you know, like ramp up the pace of the game and, you know, I don't know, do some really interesting things with it. I'd like to see that. And I think Treyarch is probably a studio, you know, more suited to doing that than High Voltage, which really was out of its element.
All things considered, High Voltage being a developer that hadn't had a lot of experience in that genre, and there not being a lot of concrete examples of original shooters on the system, you know, all the things that were working against that game, the fact that they really didn't have a good story for the game, they probably figured out the story at the very, very end, I'm sure. But all things considered, it turned out pretty well, I think. It really is a pretty decent game, and I think the hype is actually really working against this game. They spent too long talking about how awesome it was going to be, got everyone's expectations up, and when it turned out to just be a pretty good game, I think people were a little let down. I'm pleased with it. I'm happy with it.
I still feel like it was the game that everyone said that everyone else was hyped up for. I've never heard anyone actually say that they personally were hyped up for it.
Nah, I think a lot of people were.
I also think it's the game that everybody said, yeah, I can't wait to buy it, can't wait to play it, and then they played it for a week and then never touched it again.
Yeah.
I think more likely, John, they probably didn't buy it at all.
Yeah.
given the sales.
Yeah, going back to what Greg said, you're probably right.
I think it actually sold pretty decently.
Yeah, really? All things considered, I think it did sell pretty decently. But yeah, I mean, yeah, there probably are some people that didn't get the most use out of it among those, and I kind of fear I would be one of them if I were to pick it up. But you know, I mean, it is going for a very reasonable price, so I might consider it.
Yeah, and it's a very good rental, too. But, Andy, I think what you'll find is that if you play the single-player campaign through to the end, it does actually get better as you go. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the later, especially the last third of it, probably, is actually a lot more fun than the early stuff, because you have a lot more, you have more of the alien weapons and more of the Trinity or whatever they call the weapon, the kind of CIA weapons, you know, the weird DARPA shit. And to me, those weapons are better designed and more fun to use than the plain machine guns and stuff that you get early on. And the enemies become more interesting. They require a little more strategy to kill. They don't just run straight at you. You can't just shoot them in the face to kill them. And I think the level designs are actually a little more exotic, a little more interesting later on. They're not just hallways and slaughterhouse rooms, like you said.
Cool.
All right, John, you're up next, and I guess you're catching up on a couple things.
Yeah, a couple things. For Christmas, I got New Super Mario Bros. Wii and Modern Warfare 2, amongst a couple of other things that I haven't really touched because I've been trying to, you know, kind of move through those. But New Super Mario Bros. Wii, it's kind of funny because I feel like what Andy said about the conduit, it's pretty much exactly what everybody said it was. It's really good, but I was honestly kind of surprised at how much it is literally New Super Mario Brothers on the Wii. Outside of the multiplayer stuff, I mean, it is straight down the middle. I mean, now granted, I've gotten up to about the second world, beat the first two bosses. And again, why they insist on doing the whole bonk the boss three times on the head and it's dead thing. I mean, it's very good, but you know, straight down the middle, nothing really too unexpected. I have played multiplayer with my wife, and what has been entertaining about that is that it's not as, I mean, I always kind of think of, you know, these games as, you would think that they would be sort of casual friendly, I guess, but they're really not, because, I mean, my wife, she doesn't really play action games at all, and I mean, she has to grasp the concept of, you know, holding down the turbo button at all times to get the running jumps all the time. That kind of stuff, people need coaching to do that if they're not really, if they haven't played a lot of Mario games.
So she wasn't a big Mario player.
No, she's more of a fighting game, mash the button kind of player. And so it's kind of difficult for her to pick up the nuances of New Super Mario Brothers. You know, like just the little things you have to do and, you know, because there's actually a lot of technique to that game if you really want to play it well. And, you know, a lot of coordinating between the players. So it's been interesting. But, I mean, it's been fun. I mean, I really enjoy it.
I'm glad that they didn't water it down or burden it with tutorials or anything like that, though. They just kind of leave it for everyone to kind of figure it out. And, you know, I think if you're playing together, you should be able to do that, you know, as long as someone, is out in front, especially.
Mm-hmm. Man, if there's any game that doesn't need a tutorial, it's Super Mario Brothers.
I know.
You would think, but that's not the case, though. Because
But you see, with what John's saying, I could almost have imagined there might have been a temptation to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm glad they didn't, to be honest, because I think it's just better to keep it organic and as much as possible. And obviously, yes, you could assume there will be a lot of people out there that with the requisite muscle memory to get things going.
I might have mentioned this earlier, but I had a group of people over and I wanted them to play Mario with each other and with me. And some of them don't really play video games currently, and they were like, well, how do you play this? You know, what are the controls? And I said, it's Mario.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, but I mean, you have to tell me what the buttons do. And I said, turn the controller sideways and play Mario. I know you know how to do this. And they were really doubtful, but like once they started, they're like, oh, I see. Wow, this is just Mario. And out of context, that the way they said it might even have sounded disappointing, like, oh my god, this is just like Mario, but they were thrilled.
Yeah.
And they knew exactly what to do once they started it. I mean, I just had to get them to press start and get going, and once they did, there were no questions about how to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just obvious.
John, does the game feel sluggish to you?
Not really. It doesn't feel any more. I mean, it doesn't feel any different than the DS version, really.
I never thought the DS version felt sluggish, but when I got the, I just got this for Christmas. So I've only put about as much time into it as you have, but mm-hmm. it really kind of felt like Mario was running through corn syrup the entire game. I don't know if it's just me or if I haven't played enough of the DS version lately, but maybe it's just because this one's on console and I have a very distinct impression of what console Mario games should feel like. But
yeah,
it feels slow to me.
I can see how you would get that impression. I think that if you go back and play the older Mario games, I just think that the controls respond a lot more quickly. There's just a certain kind of crispness to the controls that really isn't there with New Super Mario Bros. Wii.
Maybe it's the reduced animation in the old games.
Yeah.
You know, Mario doesn't go through as many frames.
It's a bit more like World than 3 in that regard, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think 3 is a little more twitchy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the other game I've been playing Modern Warfare 2. I actually got that for Christmas as well. Johnny asked me about this a couple of weeks ago, and I had not got it at that time. But it's pretty much like New Super Mario Bros. Wii. It's sort of a lot of what I expected. I think that the single player is extremely short. It's probably, I got through it maybe about 6 hours, but you could probably do it in about 5. And when you actually do complete it, I mean, I'm not going to, like, spoil it, but you're kind of like, what, really? That's the end? Really?
Like, it ends too quickly?
It's too abrupt. Yeah, like, the credits roll, and you're like, wait a minute. That's not the
DLC.
End.
DLC.
Yeah.
That's DLC.
Well, the weird thing is, screw it, I'll spoil it a little bit, but basically the main guy that is set up as the evil terrorist, he's built up through the entire game as, you know, the Antichrist kind of thing. But you never actually face that guy. It's really weird. Hmm. It's pretty strange.
So there's no Bionic Commando moment where you go kill Hitler.
No.
His
Hitler.
Head blows up.
Nope. Yeah. Nope.
That's too bad.
Now, you know, you do face a different person who becomes your arch enemy throughout the course of the game. Yeah. But it's just kind of weird. And at the end, like, you think you're gonna go after the big guy, but then it just ends.
I think, John, you're going to have to pay 800 Microsoft points to kill the Antichrist.
No.
And I probably will, too. I'm picking this game up soon, and we'll definitely, man, we'll play some co-op and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm excited to play it. It's with travel and stuff. I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah. I mean, if you like the first one, you're going to like this one. I mean, it's very similar, but I think, I know that the multiplayer, it's been tweaked a bit. I haven't played the first one online for quite a while. So I didn't play it a ton. It's not really the whole series really isn't. It's not really my thing. So, you know, I wasn't like a Call of Duty fanboy sort of thing. But also I think the multiplayer for some reason it just seems a little bit crisper, possibly a little bit easier than it was before. I don't think it's as cheap. I know that, Andy, you've been talking about how people are complaining about, like, getting shot from off-screen and stuff.
I don't know about people. That's my personal complaint about the Call of Duty franchise in general is my experience playing Call of Duty is just take 5 steps, get shot from off-screen.
You mean like, by a sniper?
But yeah, like, it seemed like my experience playing, I played about the first half of the first Call of Duty Modern Warfare, and my experience was just, you know, you're in a trench, and you take 5 steps, and there's gunfire everywhere, and eventually some of it hits you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like open field combat games. I kind of like hallway based science fiction combat more than open field. There's 30 buildings around you. Most of them have dudes shooting at you, and you have to find cover every 5 seconds. That doesn't really appeal
to me. I do know how it can be frustrating, and usually when I start a game like this, I go through a period where that happens to me a lot. You know, I just get killed nonstop. And,
mm-hmm.
and then I stop and think, well, how am I playing this? What am I doing? I mean, if I was really on this battlefield in real life, would I just run out into the field like that and expect to survive? No, I'd probably be a lot more conservative. I'd sneak around. I'd learn the area. And ultimately, I think a lot of the enjoyment that you can have with a first-person shooter, especially Call of Duty, Modern Warfare, is that you have to learn the map. You absolutely have to learn the map.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it's tough because when you're dying that fast, you don't really get to move around a whole lot and look at where everything is. So it takes some patience, which I don't always have.
Yeah.
But if you can spend an hour or two on a map and really learn the layout and everything, you'll find that you know where people tend to be, and you know how to get from one place to the other in the safest way possible, and it really opens up your mind to the strategies and, you know, all the different tactics that are at your disposal. Also, there are things like, you know, in some games, learning where the weapons are stashed and, you know, learn where the spawn points are. I don't think that's quite as much of an issue in Call of Duty, but to me, it's all about knowing the map. And when you first pick up the game and everybody else has had it for a couple months, which is what it's going to happen with me, it can be, there's a high learning curve while you go through the process of learning that stuff. But
yeah,
once you get familiar with the map, it becomes a lot more fun.
Yeah, I mean,
it really does.
If you can make it through that learning curve, then you'll have fun with it. Another thing I would suggest is to start out with team deathmatch instead of just jumping into normal deathmatch. Because in normal deathmatch, it's all on you. And if, like Johnny said, if you don't know the maps, you will get destroyed. Whereas in team deathmatch, you know, you can kind of, typically you'll be grouped with, you know, maybe some weaker players, but sometimes you'll get with some much better players. And so if you're not as good, your crappiness can kind of be absorbed by the group, right? Like you can kind of...
And you can just imitate other people. That's one thing I'll do in team deathmatch. I did this a lot in the first Modern Warfare, is get on a team, find the best player, and follow him.
Yeah.
Because he knows where to go, and he will show you the best places on that map.
Mm-hmm.
And you can learn a lot from imitating people.
Yeah, and also, you know, you're not under a lot of pressure to go out and get as many kills as you can. You can just kind of contribute at your own pace, you know, do what you can instead of just, you know, going out and trying to kill kind of thing. Now, the one thing I will say about the single player is that, you know, Andy was talking about kind of like the open field combat. And throughout the single player, there's really not a lot of that. There's a lot of corridor shooting. I mean, in some of the levels, it gets to the point where it almost feels like a House of the Dead game.
Wow.
Because, it was really weird. I was like, a few times I was like, you know, I feel like I'm playing House of the Dead. Because, I mean, it's just like, you come into an area, it's like, I mean, you only have like maybe two ways to go, like two kind of hallways to go down, and a bunch of guys pop out, you kill them, you move forward, a bunch of guys pop out, you kill them, move forward, and it's really, really briskly paced, like a House of the Dead game is. So it's one of the most briskly paced games I've ever played. I mean, it's just boom, 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 next level, boom, 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 next level. I mean, and the first one was like that, but this one's even more like that.
I think one of these days I'm going to sit down and actually play through both the Modern Warfare games, because it's going to be one of those things that I do way after the fact. Because honestly, I found the first one pretty frustrating, and I'm not looking forward to going back, but I'd like to not be out of the loop whenever people talk about Modern Warfare games,
yeah,
which it seems to be increasingly more often.
Well, the good thing about them is the fact that they're not very long.
Yeah.
Mm. What do you think contributes to the mass appeal? Is it anything about the game design? You know, like if you look at it compared to something like Halo, which obviously has similar kind of mass appeal, is there a common thread in terms of the kind of shooter that it is?
It's very arcadey.
So, or is it just the graphical performance of the online multiplayer that kind of...
No, because I think that there's a lot of graphically beautiful first-person shooters out there. I think that it has more to do with the subject matter. I mean, a lot of people, you know, Modern Warfare 2, there are times where it borders on American propaganda, pretty much. With the amount... the kind of like, I mean, there's, you know, because it shows you a quote whenever you die, like some sort of military style quote, and there's like a lot of them are like, you know, completely pro-American, like they're not just quotes about war in general, they're specifically pro-American quotes, and I don't know how they've changed those for other countries. It would be interesting. I'd like to see something, you know, like the PAL version of the game or something like that, just to see if they change up those quotes. But I also think the fact that the gameplay is very quick, relatively easy to understand. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a Twitch shooter, but it's close. Like, it's not Unreal Tournament, but it's lightning fast. So, and it's also very polished.
There's a level up component to the multiplayer, isn't there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That always helps.
That makes it really addictive.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can keep going through. And the thing is, they've even upped the ante with that, with all of the personalized kind of stuff that you can add to your character now. Like, whenever somebody kills you, it shows you their emblem and stuff like that. So you can have like the American flag pop up, and you have all these kind of different titles you can get, like MMORPG style, like you were killed by Xbox Live Boy 245 serial killer kind of thing, you know? So,
well, speaking of American flags,
mm-hmm.
I was hoping to have a report on my encounter with Billy Mitchell earlier today, mm-hmm. but
that's a lot for people to absorb in one go. Yeah, drop it like that.
I'm proud to be an American. What?
USA. Premier purveyor of hot sauce and dubious Indeed. Video submitter extraordinaire.
Well, I hope everyone has seen The King of Kong, the documentary. If not, you really... I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you really should see The King of Kong. It's absolutely fantastic. And there's no doubt it is unfair to some of the people in the film. And the way it is edited, it's edited to tell a story, not necessarily to tell the truth. And I, you know, I understand that fully. I know a lot of people who appear in the film have come out and said, well, it's not really, doesn't really portray me in a fair way. And look, that happens with every documentary. But it is a wonderful, wonderful movie. It is, you know, it's all more or less reality. It's about people who play classic video games and are very serious about it. And the movie is absolutely hilarious. So Billy Mitchell is actually kind of the villain in The King of Kong. But I've known about Billy Mitchell for a long time before that movie ever came out. And actually, Walter Day, he's the Twin Galaxies referee guy. I used to exchange emails with him years ago, way before the movie came out, so it was really trippy seeing him as one of the principal characters in that movie. But anyway, I'm down in South Florida for the week to cover the Phish concerts in Miami up to New Year's Eve.
For NWR, of course.
Yeah, I'll be writing an extensive blog post about the Nintendo coverage.
Phish Rock Band?
Yeah, I'm just here, dude. That I would, you know, never.
You just download one song that's 100 days long.
Yeah, they. I mean, their songs. They're commonly over 10 minutes, but it's awesome. They play four. This is the second time they've done it. They play four nights in a row in Miami, leading up to New Year's Eve. They don't repeat any songs over the four nights, so they'll play 80, 90 songs over those four nights, and. Every night the shows are 3-4 hours long. It's crazy. It's a lot of fun, and it's totally worth traveling all the way down here for. So this is the second time I've done this. Last time I didn't get out that much. I didn't go around a whole lot. This time I've been exploring a little bit more. I've seen more of the city, and one of the things I want to do is, after having seen King of Kong, is visit Billy Mitchell's famous restaurant in Hollywood, Florida, and it's called Ricky's, actually, with an E, Ricky's Famous Restaurant, and we went by there. According in the movie, it kind of indicates that Billy's there all the time, and apparently he was back in 2006, 2007 when the movie was being made. And unfortunately, when we went today and had lunch there, Billy was not around, and the bartender told us that he doesn't come around very much these days. But so I didn't get a chance to meet Billy Mitchell. I was really hoping to. I wanted to like, you know, put my arm around him with a hidden pair of scissors and cut off his mullet and put that up on my wall.
Could have given him a maple leaf tie and said it was from John.
Yeah. That's supposedly why he started wearing the American flag ties, is that he was in a Pac-Man competition with a guy from Canada who wore a maple leaf tie. And so Billy wanted to represent.
There's a Canadian version of Billy Mitchell out there.
Maybe every country has one.
But actually, the restaurant is, I mean, the food was fine. It's chicken wings, chicken fingers, hamburgers, soups and salads. It's pretty typical American stuff. But the only thing notable I would say is, one, there are a couple of old arcade games in the corner, but no Pac-Man, no Donkey Kong. Very sad. It's like Daytona USA and some other shit.
Oh, of course. You gotta have that. You want to be able to listen to the song while you're eating, obviously.
Yeah. But in another corner, there's a huge banner on the wall with an American flag and a bald eagle, and the slogan on it says, "Whatever it takes."
That's awesome. If it means fabricating the video, so be it.
Yes, I think maybe that was. Great. I think that banner was maybe donated by Dick Cheney. But yeah. Whoa, whatever it takes. I don't know. I don't know if that's. Anyway, so that was the only kind of thing that reminded me of Billy in the restaurant was the banner. But Yeah, unfortunately, Billy wasn't there, so I just I had a beer and left.
Speaking of locations from The King of Kong, true story. My honeymoon last September took me to Laconia, New Hampshire, which happens to be the location of Fun Spot, the arcade from The King of Kong.
Yeah, so nice.
I played a game of Donkey Kong on the same machine that Steve Wiebe played in that movie.
Proud
to say. I did not get a kill screen, as it turns out.
No, I understand that's quite difficult.
It's actually a really, really awesome arcade. Like, they call it a museum, sort of. They have, like, 3 or 4 floors, and, like, the top floor is all the classic arcade stuff, and it's all in perfect condition. Everything you could think of, like Gorf, Blueprint, two of my favorite old Commodore 64 games. They have tons of stuff. And then all the way down to the bottom floor, which is more recent stuff like modern versions of Daytona USA and NASCAR driving games. But it's a killer arcade. If you're ever in New Hampshire up by Lake Winnipesaukee, I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Yeah, there actually another arcade from the movie is in Hollywood, Florida, near not too close, but you know, within a few miles of Billy's restaurant. And was planning to go there. I didn't have time today. I might get to later in the week. I've actually been there before, but it was like 10 years ago. I didn't appreciate it at the time. But it's one of the best arcades left in America. So I'm hoping to go by there. And if I do, I'll talk about it next week. Excellent. But as far as the games I've been playing, I haven't touched it in over a week now because I didn't bring my Wii on vacation with me. But I did rent A Boy and His Blob. And I played a good bit of it. I played through about half of it before I had to leave for Christmas. And I'm very glad I've played it. I'm not sure that I would have wanted to buy it, but I do think it is very, very good, and it seems like there's a lot of content there. So if you're really over the moon for how the game plays, then or how it looks, maybe, mm-hmm. You shouldn't hesitate to go out and pick up a copy of it. For me, it's a little bit too slow-paced. There are just elements of it. There are little aspects of it that I don't love, but I appreciate what it's doing. And I think A Boy and His Blob, well, definitely the art is wonderful, really, really excellent. I think it looks better than Muramasa, but maybe it's just my preference for the art direction.
Yeah, that's a matter of taste, probably, isn't it? I mean, I haven't played both, but I would have thought so. But it stands up really well, however you want to look at it.
For sure, yeah. In Muramasa, there's more animation in the backgrounds, which is really impressive when you see these giant, you know, you see the tide coming up on the beach and everything. Everything seems to always be kind of glistening or, you know, vibrating or just moving a little bit in the background of Muramasa, and it gives the scenes a really nice, I don't know, a liveliness. A Boy and His Blob, the backgrounds tend to be more static, and it's more about the way the characters animate. But I do kind of like the art better. I'm not really into the whole Japanese anime type of art, so I prefer A Boy and His Blob in that sense. But the gameplay is fine. It's just very slow paced, and you know, it's not even so much that you're doing puzzle solving. Certainly, I expected that. It's not really an action oriented game. It's about, you know, figuring out how to get from here to there or how to grab that thing. But what I find is that there's a little too much of waiting for Blob to catch up. And
absolutely. Yeah.
The fact that you're controlling two characters, it just ends up, and this extends to Spirit Tracks, which is the other game I've been playing, but when you're controlling both of these characters, there's a lot of kind of waiting around for one to catch up to the other. And I could kind of do without that. And I feel like it's just the kind of thing that probably could have been avoided with a little bit of programming and very slight design changes. I like how Blob is used. I like the different forms that he takes. A lot of them are from the original A Boy and His Blob, but some of them are new. And the new ones are really interesting, actually. But I'm not that big of a fan of how you aim the jelly beans, you know, how you kind of place them, because a lot of times they're, you know, you can be off by a few pixels and that ladder is not going to work. So you have to be very meticulous about where you place the jelly bean. And I kind of feel like if you're going to be that picky about where I throw it, then let me point at the screen exactly where I want to throw it rather than use this weird angle thing. And, you know, the way that you place jelly beans is kind of crappy, I think.
I mean, it kind of comes into play in some puzzles later on where you are kind of, you know, the fact that you're throwing it is kind of part of the puzzle, really, rather than just, like, where you're placing it. But it's, yeah, it's a little fiddly, and it's always slow, like switching between the beads and waiting for blah blah. It's got this kind of very staccato kind of rhythm to the gameplay as a result. But I mean, from what I've played, I've just played into the third hub world, so it's a little more than sort of halfway through. And it seemed, Andy, you reviewed this for us.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you could tell me about this, because it seems like it's taken something of a turn in this third world, where it is actually getting a little more action-based in a way. You know, you've got these levels where you're piloting the rocket ship form all around, or you're firing yourself out of a cannon and all that. The puzzles almost have been a bit de-emphasized for the last few levels I've played. I was wondering if this is something that kind of continues in the latter half.
I don't think it's a particularly dramatic shift, but yeah, I do agree that once they throw the hamster ball thing and the rocket and the cannonball, all of those things definitely definitely require a lot more careful aiming and careful action-y things once they're used. But I will tell you that the final of the four worlds is very puzzle heavy.
Right.
The levels start to drag on, actually, in my opinion, towards the end of the game. And some people might say it's the best part of the game, depending on what your favorite part of the game is. If you're planning, well, it depends on if you're planning on getting all three of the chests the first time through. I kind of stopped after a while, but the 10 levels in the last world can take 20 to 40 minutes a piece, sometimes even longer. It gets a little weary after a while. It's hard to want to play through a lot of it in one sitting, because you finally finish one and you're like, whoa, man, I could use a break.
Right.
Because it's mentally exhausting.
You certainly can play it level by level, and it's interesting, minimalist sort of approach to the interface and the presentation and everything. You know, I mean, this is a game essentially without text. You wouldn't have to localize the game at all. I mean, all the menus are sort of laid out essentially without a menu. It's all kind of built into the hub worlds and all this sort of stuff, which I thought was a very sort of nice, clean, organic kind of presentation. But it does have the problem of that you couldn't have two save files going on at once for different people in the same household, which is could be a problem.
It also has the problem where it doesn't really teach you how to do certain things that you need to know how to do. I mean, there was like what you were talking about earlier, Greg, there are puzzles where you need to throw a jelly bean underneath something or across a pit to get Blob to go over there, because the boy can't actually get over there. And yeah. I didn't know you could throw jelly beans. I thought you could only just kind of dump them out next to you. I mean, I had to go to GameFAQs and it says, just throw a jelly bean over there. It's like, what? You can do that? I went back and messed around with it and figured out how to do that. But it's not at all obvious that you can aim your jelly bean throws.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I guess if you just happen to flick your analog stick at some point while doing it, then you'll see the trajectory line and you'll get it. But early on, you don't really have a reason to do that.
Right. They certainly could have done one of the wooden signs or whatever and kind of indicated how that's done. And they just, it's like they forgot. And then they start throwing puzzles at you where you have to be able to do that. And I'm like,
no, I mean, you're right. I mean, if you had a wooden sign with a dotted line coming from the boy's hand, you'd probably figure that that's all you'd probably need.
Yeah, but that's all I need.
There's no such sign. So it's not as if you'd have to break the no text sort of paradigm of the game's presentation.
Right. Yeah. I think they just didn't bother.
The game does rely pretty heavily on trial and error, and a lot of that also comes down to which of your blob objects will kill enemies and which ones won't. Like, if I go into a rocket and I ram into something, am I going to die? If I drop a anvil on something, is it going to die? It is a lot of trial and error. Everything your blob turns into interacts with enemies differently, it seems.
Now, is any of that based on if somebody had played the first game, would they know what to do? Okay.
I mean, the first game is so old. It's very different from the first game in good ways. I mean, the first game is a mess.
Yeah.
So it shares the basic concept with the first game, but beyond that, they don't have a whole lot in common.
Yeah.
And that's good.
I will say that that a lot of your complaints, Johnny, are especially noticeable, especially the pixel perfect jelly bean throwing is especially noticeable during boss fights. Some of those boss fights are really a hair.
Yeah, I think some of these things could be avoided, and it's a shame because, like, the only, well, I've only, I'm almost to the second boss, I think. But the first boss I thought was really interesting and, you know, like really well designed, really interesting concept, but it's just a little more cumbersome than it should be in terms of moving around and figuring out what works and what doesn't work, because maybe it didn't work because it's the wrong approach, or maybe it didn't work because you didn't push that anvil quite far enough to the right, you know? Mm-hmm. So they're just, I don't know. I think it could be polished up. It sounds like they're going to make a sequel to it, and I think that's great. I think it's a really excellent first game in a series. And I think there's you know, a number of small things they could do to improve it. I'd like to be able to reorder the jelly beans on my little circular menu, because the thing is, the game gives you a loadout. It's not even, I mean, it's weird because you go into a level and you immediately check the menu to see what jelly beans you've got. And sometimes you just get to a new level and, oh, now I can turn into a rocket ship. It's not really clear why, you know, there's no story conceit for why you can now use the rocket ship and you couldn't in all the earlier levels. It just, oh, now it's there. Now I can do it. And what annoys me is not that. It's the fact that some of the really basic jelly beans, like the ladder or the hole in the ground or the balloon that makes the blob come back to you if he's way off the screen, those things tend to get shoved around the menus so that they're in different positions based on which level you're in. And it's all very arbitrary. It's like, you know, can I please just assign these so that they're in the same spots every level, and that way I don't have to fumble through here and look for the jelly bean I want every single time? Because there's no consistency to that menu at all. They just get shuffled around every time. Well, anyway, obviously it's a game that has a lot of little frustrations for me, but like on the whole, I do like it a lot, and I think it has a lot of great puzzles, a lot of great ideas. You know, it does remind me quite a bit of Tokitori, and if you like Tokitori on WiiWare, which is a really good 2D puzzle game, I hope a lot of people have played it, then, you know, A Boy and His Blob is like a refinement of Tokitori, I think, and it's held together by a better world, a better story, a better character. You know, everything about it is just a little, it's just better. It's more professional, it's more polished. So, anyway, the other game I've been playing the past week, and I have been playing this more recently on the road, is Zelda Spirit Tracks, which, as I noted, I kind of indicated that I would last time. I picked it up for $25 at Target. For that price, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I am very near the end of it now. And I guess I've enjoyed it. It's given me something to do, which for a DS game is, you know, that's what I'm going for a lot of times. I don't even know if I like it as much as Phantom Hourglass, really. But it's okay. It's definitely not my favorite Zelda game, and I knew it wouldn't be. You know, I went into it with pretty low expectations. It has succeeded those on certain points. It has met them on a lot of others. So for me, it's just okay. But I didn't hate it. I've like I said, I've played through nearly all of it now, and I'm gonna finish it. So for me, the big problem with Spirit Tracks is the train. It is way, way too slow. There's just no reason for it to be that slow. And I keep waiting for it to get faster. like, you know, once you get to the point where you can trade for upgrades to your train, I thought, oh, now, you know, I can get an engine that'll be faster. But for one thing, I haven't seen that the engines actually make you faster. I've only got one upgraded engine, and it didn't make any difference noticeable.
Nah, I didn't even bother with all that stuff.
It's just cosmetic, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what was it? In Phantom Hourglass, if you got a bunch of parts that kind of matched, it increased the health of your boat.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what it did. Now, naturally assumed that it would be the same way. No NOS thing to put on the choo-choo, unfortunately.
No, it sure does need it, man.
Spirit Tracks Nitro?
It's weird. And then you have these warp points, these warp gates that you can go
through.
Oh,
the warp system is balls. It's why is it so much worse than the one in Phantom Hourglass?
Yeah, it's really complicated because you have these gates and they're scattered all over the place, but each gate connects to one other specific gate and you have to go through it to figure out which two connect. And so you have to kind of mark it on your map. It's very cumbersome to do this. And even then, sometimes there may be two gates in the forest region that connect to two gates in the snow region, and you have to figure out which one goes to which, and, you know, in the heat of the moment, you probably won't even remember, and you'll be sitting there staring at your map trying to figure out which one goes to which.
It's completely sort of counterintuitive that, you know, a system that you would think has the purpose of being more convenient is just fails to kind of meet that primary criterion quite spectacular. Because in Phantom Hourglass, as simple as you pulled up the thing, you drew a symbol on there which corresponded to a point on the map, and you just went there from wherever you were. So, you know, that was pretty instant, but whereas this is this whole sort of, it's not really a warp thing, pure warp thing as much as just a minor shortcut system, which is so kind of not transparent that it's not very useful. So I kind of just suffered through all the train riding absentmindedly.
Yeah, and the other thing is, actually, one thing I like about the train system is that as you complete these little side quests for characters and you make people happy, they give you these yellow force gems that looks like a piece of a Triforce, and it makes new pieces of rail appear on the map.
Yeah.
Which, that got me excited, because I'm like, oh, maybe there is a little bit of exploration here. But the problem is that these extra train tracks that appear when you meet certain criteria, they don't really go anywhere a lot of the time. A lot of times they're dead ends, or they just connect two points that you could already get between almost just as easily. So a lot of times it's just kind of a parallel path to one that you already had. And, you know, you go down it, and maybe there's a new warp gate there that may match up with one you found earlier somewhere else. So now you can connect those two points, but you didn't really need to. You know, like, the only reason that you would need that warp gate is so you can do more side quests more conveniently to make more tracks appear. And I just feel like it's weird, because I get this, like, little tinge of excitement in my brain when a new track opens up, and then I go down it, and I'm like, oh, that's it?
Yeah.
You know?
Wah, wah, wah.
The most useful thing that could be on that section of track is a warp gate, which is not really that useful.
I honestly just didn't. I mean, like, for me, I was enjoying the dungeon so much, I just wanted to get on with it. There's not a lot of fetch questy stuff that you have to do. There is a little, which, you know, is not that fun to do. But I haven't replayed Phantom Hourglass, and I doubt I'll replay this one. That's the one thing about it. Like, I really enjoyed this one in terms of the dungeons, but the fact that all the stuff in between is as kind of perfunctory as it's ever been.
This is like the worst positive review of a game I've ever heard. It's like, yeah, you know, it's like pretty much every single one of you saying, yeah, I just put my time in. I kind of did it,
in between are exactly that. But then, for me, as a fan of the dungeons, the puzzle-solving elements of Zelda, I think this is really good. When you get to those parts, they're really good.
I'm kind of half in agreement with you on the dungeons, Greg. There are things in the dungeons that I think are genius, that are really good, that are among the best mini puzzles, you know, like self-contained little clever things. I mean, the way that you use your boomerang to create ice trails over pits of water, it's wonderful stuff. But then there is a lot of, you know, write down the order of these eyes to shoot with your arrow, and I'm just like, this was not fun in Phantom Hourglass. It's not fun in Spirit Tracks.
And it's, in some of the cases, it's lifted straight out as well.
Exactly.
You know, that sort of stuff, again, I'm not happy with that. But the stuff that's there that's really good, and also the bosses, I think the boss fight's quite
The bosses are fantastic.
This diktat, the absolute cast iron rule of three, as we were told when we interviewed
Jeff Callis,
we interviewed Geist. Jeff told us about the rule of three, and it is a rule. But in this case, it was not really that abundant at all. A lot of the bosses are just to sort of have their own particular structure, which I thought was really nice. So all of those sorts of things, I think, are quite, you know, exceptional for recent Zelda games, but it is a shame that some of the surrounding parts are, you know, a bit phoned in or whatever. But the thing is, as I said with the handheld game, one can phone those parts in yourself, and therefore kind of just get along with it.
Well, the other aspect of the dungeons is the stuff in the Spirit Tower, where you control Link and Zelda as a, you know, as she's one of the Phantom Guards. And I actually am not... Greg, you said this was your favorite part of the game.
Yeah, I love of that stuff. Some of the stuff's really clever and really fun.
Clever, maybe, but I find that... Well, first of all, a lot of it's contingent upon stealth gameplay, which Zelda has tried on numerous occasions
and really has never worked well.
It's
not nearly as prevalent as it was in the Phantom Hourglass, though. I mean, you've got that first part of each component of the Tower of Spirits has a first phase where you're getting the three tiers of light, which then means you can dispense with stealth from then on. And even then,
it's not configured
around like really carefully getting from safe zone to safe zone or anything like that. It's pretty heavily watered down, I think.
Yeah, but it just, you know, it reminds me of the stuff in Wind Waker early on, which I never liked that much.
No, yeah.
It's not that heavy, though.
Really
no, but it just doesn't need to be there, in my opinion. It's not any better than it has been in the previous games. It's just not
less
as much
bad,
of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty modest improvement. And then once you know Zelda possesses one of these Phantom Guards and you can control her, that stuff, you know, the level design definitely becomes interesting at that point because of the things you can do controlling two characters. You know, Link can go some places the Phantom can't and vice versa, and so you're trying to, you know, you separate them for a little while and then you try to do, you hit some switches and stuff so they can meet back up and finally go up to the next floor. I mean, there's some interesting elements of that. What I find annoying is the way you control Zelda or the Phantom. I don't like drawing a path for her constantly. And the way that she follows you, when you put her on automatic, she follows behind Link. And a lot of times, that's not really that useful because, you know, she can kill enemies. Sometimes she lights the way with her flaming sword. You'd really prefer for her to be leading Link. Walking a couple steps in front of you, not behind you. And you can't make that happen unless you draw a path for her and follow her. It's just the way it's controlled, I don't really like very much, and it makes it feel very slow. It makes it feel like you're doing a lot of things twice instead of just once. That's my complaint about it. Design-wise, it's very, very good. I mean, those dungeons are very well designed. There's some great ideas.
And it's just different ideas as well, you know, because that is something that, you know, when you've done as many of these games as they've done with Zelda, you know, there's an element of, you know, recycling and all that. But a lot of this is, you know, the puzzles involving the two of them feels really original. I really like the stuff where you have to get them onto the platforms that switch them in place. Those are really clever. That particular sequence is excellent.
Yeah, I'm not as enamored with it as you are. But I will definitely concede the point that it's new. I mean, it's definitely fresh for Zelda. Those dungeons, that stuff is, it's new material, and there's a lot to be said for that. It's the execution that I'm not that crazy about, but there's some good ideas in there. Anyway, I'm done, and Greg's going to wrap up new business now.
Yep, so I've mostly been playing the original Metroid Prime on the Metroid Prime Trilogy, actually, because I got that for Christmas. I've been wanting to play it for a while, replay it, and I didn't get round to it on GameCube for a few years, and then obviously the Trilogy news kind of started to come out, and so I've been waiting until I would get my hands on it. So it's been about 6 years, 6.5, since I actually played the original Metroid Prime. And play through it now. I've enjoyed it a lot. I switched the hint system off and just tried to go by memory and intuition. And with the new controls, making the experience quite a lot faster, that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it is still an excellent game. One of my favourite of the last 10 years, certainly. I guess one of the things that I noticed about it, playing through it at, you know, reasonable speed, and having, you know, played the sequel since, is that the combat and things like that are actually really quite straightforward. I've forgotten how straightforward it was in that regard, you know, the bosses, things like that. I mean, really, when you think about Metroid Prime 2, where they went with stuff like, you have Quadraxis, the giant robot with the, you know, with the four legs, or the Chica lava that turns into a moth and all that. I mean, they went far, far more complex latterly. And then, of course, once you get to Metro Prime 3, they know they're using a more fluid control scheme, so it kind of became more about shooting and all sorts of things. With this, it's quite straightforward. And I think, you know, one of those things where you gain a sort of appreciation for what came later. But one thing that continues to impress me is the continuity of the world, how it all links together when you're exploring it. And of course, what's especially impressive about that, as Johnny's recounted on the show long ago, is that how quickly they made all that. Is that it basically came together in, what was the figure? How many months was
like
it?
Like about 9 months. It's
Nine months. That part of it is amazing because I think all the Metroid Prime environments since have not felt that continuous. Obviously, Prime 3 doesn't even try because it has the separate planets. And then 2 has the dual structure, which is kind of strange, obviously. But you know, that organic, continuous, well, as continuous as they could make it, obviously you've got the elevators and all that, environment is still the most impressive thing about the game.
It, and the world is absolutely enormous. I think when people talk about Echoes, the second game, I think some people kind of diss on the dual world structure because they feel like maybe the developer was being kind of lazy with that, or they just wanted to reuse a lot of geometry, you know, to save themselves some time. And I think it's actually for a very different reason that Retro went with that. I think it's probably to keep the game manageable for the player in terms of learning the map layouts and everything, because I think they had a lot of ideas for places that they wanted to put in the game, and they realized that if they strung it all together in one continuous world, it would be so enormous and complex that nobody would be able to navigate the world.
Yeah, I think it's a valid concern.
What if we take all of these room ideas and everything and stack them on top of each other so that in a lot of senses you only have to learn each area once, but then you can play through it twice in two very different ways? You know, that might be interesting. So the way you would go through this room in the light world is completely different from the way you would go through it in the dark world, but it's still the same basic layout of the room, so you don't have to memorize it twice. Because I feel like Metroid Prime, the first one, I feel like by the end of the game, when you've got the mine and the Phazon areas and everything, it can be a bit overwhelming in terms of, well, I need to get from this point to this point. It's going to take me 30 minutes, and I might get lost a couple times on the way.
Yeah, the 3D map is not the most easy to read either.
Yeah, it's cool, but not exactly functional.
Compared to Super Metroid, it's like, okay, boom, boom. It's not quite the same, is it? One thing I was impressed with, though, playing with the hint system off, is that the way the game is designed, it does kind of prod you in the right direction without just telling you go there if you did have it switched off. But sometimes, also on the flip side of that, you can, it leaves the open for you to go up what are blind alleys. You know, that you will go so far. It's like, oh, I could go to this place now because I've got the grapple beam. And then you go 10, 15 minutes down the line using the grapple beam, and then you come to the plasma beam door. And it's like, well, it was pointless me going this far with the grapple beam because I had to have the plasma beam to actually complete this journey anyway. Yeah. So perhaps you might have been better off putting that red door a few rooms earlier to prevent that particular blind alley. But in general, I think it's the world design is the triumph of the game, and they kind of really beefed up the other aspects in the later ones. But obviously, I'd be interested to see if what they're doing next, Retro, whether, you know, obviously we assume it won't be anything to do with Metroid, will be something that's focused more than ever on a continuous world, because they got away from that in the later ones. So yeah. I'd kind of like to see what they could do with doing one of those again. The only other thing I wanted to mention this week, I've been playing a few other things like Chrono Trigger, but there's not a whole lot to say about that.
It's awesome.
It's good, and I've been playing it.
Yeah, I'm about 2,000 hours into that, by the way.
Yeah.
Just to give you an update, but you might need one.
2,000 hours in, and he's up to the trial, I think. Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit past that.
Yeah, I'm up to the battle with Magus, for the record. That took about 6 hours.
Right.
I've got, for the Japanese virtual console, a very purposefully obscure choice this one. This is called Space Manbo. This is now, Johnny expressed some quizzical kind of sentiment upon hearing that name. Well, the reason why it's so weird is because apparently it's a bit of, you know, dodgy Japanese English. It's actually meant to be Space Mambo, as in the fish, the Mambo, because the spaceship that you pilot looks like this fish in sort of mechanical spaceship form. But,
a Darius game?
It is a little bit. It's not as fishy as Darius, but there's quite a few sort of fish bosses and all this sort of stuff, but not quite all the way there. But yeah, it's Konami for the MSX in Japan. So the MSX was sort of like a PC kind of standard in Japan that didn't really catch on anywhere else, and it was, you know, somewhat significant gaming platform that kind of was going along at the same time as the Famicom. And the biggest supporters of it I could see of the MSX really were Konami, because they had a lot of prominent games on it.
They had Metal Gear and...
Yeah, the original kind of stuff, Metal Gear. They had conversions of Gradius and things like that. And also Vampire Killer, which is sort of like an alternate version of Castlevania. They came out around the same time, but the thing is the MSX at that point couldn't do scrolling, so it's a screen by screen game. I think it's quite different from the actual Castlevania we have on the NES / Famicom. So I'd be kind of curious to see if they ever release that on virtual console and see how different it is. But this is a later MSX game. It's from 1989. I think it was the MSX 2 or whatever by this point.
So it does scroll.
It scrolls. But
your side-scrolling shooter does scroll.
It's side-scrolling shooter does scroll. Well, apparently they did some weird trick with like the first Gradius conversion with the way it redraws the screen. So it kind of doesn't scroll, actually. with this one, it does scroll, but you could tell it's not really that comfortable with it, because it's actually the pace of it is quite fast, but it's a little jerky, it's a little framey, if you like, you know, it's not quite comfortable with how fast it's going, which can make certain things a little difficult to judge. But it's really quite busy, really quite complicated for what is essentially like an 8-bit shoot 'em up. I guess it wouldn't have really stood up that well with the Turbo Graphics games that were coming out at the time. But there's some interesting ideas in it. It's an original game. It's quite a lot like Gradius, but it's not, you know, an arcade conversion or anything. It was just made for the MSX. And one of the coolest things, I think, is you get option-style kind of power-ups like Gradius, but you can actually configure which way they shoot, which is not something that came into Gradius for ages later, as
until
far as
I'm 5.
Aware. On the fly, you can cycle between shooting up and down, behind you, or forward. And the way the levels are designed kind of makes use of that in certain cases as well. And then the power-up system's a little different, because there's a component of it where you've just, you know, the classic shooter mass accumulation of power. You get speed-ups, you get multi-directional weapons, whatever, and of course the options. But you also have this thing where you collect these red orbs, which kind of like level up your weapon. And the thing is, when you die, or even when you have to use a continue, you don't lose all of those.
That sounds a lot like Darius Twin on Super Nintendo, actually.
It may be a little bit like
similar
that.
System.
So it's a kind of like, if you've been playing for a long time and you keep going and stuff, you know, yes, you'll lose some of your firepower, but you're not going all the way back to scratch. So I think that's a kind of a nice thing to have in there, to kind of, you know, reward people for being persistent to some extent. Although the red sort of orbs can fade away if you don't collect any for a long time. But yeah, it's a cool little tutor. It's the kind of thing we'll never get outside of Japan, because, you know, the MSX, whatever. I mean, that is not happening, I don't think, on virtual console. And it's a super obscure game even among those. You know, it's not Metal Gear or Parodius, which is also going to come out for the Japanese virtual console. But I would mention what is coming out for Japanese virtual console. I know James is very excited about is Ogre Battle 64. That's confirmed to be coming in January.
In Japan.
Mm-hmm. In Japan. And, of course, we had the rating news in Australia already, which suggests that it could be coming for a PAL Wild Territories launch. But what's interesting about that is that it was never published in Europe by anyone, so it would be an import title. But, of course, that eliminates any kind of rankling about who published it originally, whereas, of course, in America it was published by Atlas.
I feel like in America, those rights have probably reverted back to Square Enix, I would think. Or at least Nintendo, who published it in Japan.
Hopefully, you know, we're all set for it coming out everywhere. Not least because in Japan, that would make it the first N64 game in 8 months.
Whoa!
Yeah, Majora's Mask being its immediate predecessor in the Virtual Console library. So good to see you paying a little bit of attention.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, and that's a big game. I think that, you know, releasing that will make a lot of people happy. And, I mean, you know, for what it's worth, Ogre Battle 64, or it was actually called Ogre Battle 3 in Japan, was extremely popular in Japan. I mean, it was a, you know, kind of a secret cult hit in America, but as with all the Ogre Battle games, you know, they're very niche in America. But in Japan, that was a well-known series, and Ogre Battle 3 was a pretty big deal. And, you know, I mean, it's Enix. You know, anything that Enix put out and still puts out to this day is kind of paid a lot of attention in Japan. So that'll probably be a big hit over there. Where I think it's a bit riskier in America as in terms of how many people would really download it. But
yeah, if it looks like, and obviously these rating things are hardly ironclad, but if it looks like they're going to do it in Europe where it's never released, then unless there are some legal wranglings or some other nonsense to hold it up in America, then you'd think they'd be good for that eventually.
Yeah, I got a feeling that when a company like Atlas signs an agreement to publish an Enix game like Ogre Battle 64 in America, that deal is probably has a time limit on it.
Yeah.
So it's a question of how long it takes, and it's been over 10 years, so I'm sure that has reverted back to Enix by now. And Enix has been fairly good, Square Enix, I should say, has been fairly good about publishing things on Virtual Console in America. So I feel like this is probably going to happen.
Yeah,
and
we've got the Super NES one there, and we've got, you know, stuff like ActRaiser, and there's plenty of reason to think it'll be
still
there.
Waiting on Illusion of Gaia, but
it just could. The other Quintet games. What about those?
Yeah,
Secret of Evermore.
Oh.
Yeah, Evermore, I think should. I mean, they're not gonna make any money on that any other way.
Yeah.
Put it on virtual. I mean, you know, put it on Virtual Console. Yeah, I think people would buy it. I might even buy that.
I'd probably buy it.
It's a lost gem. Severely overlooked, underrated game. Anyway, we better wrap up new business here. It's been a big one, and we're gonna take a break. Come back with a bit of listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome to 2010. It may be a new year, but Nintendo World Report's coverage is as great as ever.
On the Wii review front, Neil gives us his official take on Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles The Crystal Bearers, and Zach reviews Stunt Cars.
Pedro blogs about his experience as a volunteer Christmas employee at his local GameStop, and Lindy blogs about an RFN listener going above and beyond the call of duty.
James also has impressions of The Skycrawler's Innocent Aces, giving us his thoughts on its unique control setup.
Of course, look to Nintendo World Report for the best daily coverage of Nintendo on the web. Also be sure to check out our sister podcast, the NWR Newscast, and Radio Trivia. Happy New Year, everyone!
Time for listener mail. These people wrote in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and so can you. And the first letter is from Juan, a new listener, who writes, "My question relates to a childhood memory of mine. When I was in fifth grade, I was reading through Nintendo Power magazine when I discovered the game Uniracers. It was all I wanted for Christmas. Unfortunately, it was sold out everywhere I could go. But of course, my parents weren't leaving me empty-handed. Scared of what I was going to get, I noticed that my Christmas tree had two boxes, which looked very familiar to the size and diameter of Super NES boxes. Call me ecstatic. As soon as I opened them, though, I looked with dismay. There it was, a copy of Home Alone 2, probably the worst game I still have in my SNES catalog. The other was Zombies Ate My Neighbors. Luckily, I fell in love with zombies, which shows that even if your parents randomly choose anything they see as remotely interesting, their choices will inevitably be hit or miss, or hit and miss in this case. Which leads to my question, what's the worst game-related present you guys have ever gotten? Definitely the prize goes to my grandpa, who got me the game X-Zone for the Super NES. Why was it the worst? Because I didn't even own the Super Scope light gun. To this day, I haven't even played it. That's a great question, Juan. Well, who wants to go first with the worst game present you ever got? Doesn't have to be for Christmas, but...
I think mine would have to be a Total Recall for the NES.
Legendary.
Yeah, that game is awful in so many ways. I don't even think I had seen the movie at that point. Well, because
you'd be too
little,
you'd be
certain...
too small, wouldn't you?
That was a rated R movie, I'm pretty sure. I think.
Get your ass to Mars.
If not, it was PG-13, and I sure as hell wasn't 13 yet. Yeah, I got that game when I was pretty young, and you know, I think I actually made an honest effort to play through it, but it's hard to make an honest effort to play through that game. That game is really, really bad.
According to EGM, it was pretty much unplayable. That was the big. Yeah. That was the. They had a big fallout with the publisher.
I don't really. I haven't got one for this, to be honest, because I know you've kind of said something similar. I think, Johnny, that you pretty much called all the Christmas quote unquote gifts related to games, which, I mean, you couldn't afford to have a misstep when you were talking 80 quid a pop in the Super Famicom import days. Mm-hmm. I've told people before about the best whatever was Majora's Mask and Sinner Punishment Tag Team Christmas, which was excellent. But I just don't have one that was that bad. I mean, I didn't enjoy Smash TV that much, but it wasn't bad.
All right, John, you can do better.
No. The good thing is, I mean, everybody that has ever given me games has either I've either said don't buy me any games because I buy them all myself, or I've studiously supervised the entire game buying process so they could never ever take any chance to buy me anything bad.
Literally just, yeah, when their hand reaches out for chicken shoot, just put a little gurney underneath their feet and wheel them down the aisle.
Yeah, make sure I carry the little stick with me into Toys R Us just to, no, don't do that. Probably, I mean, the only thing I can think of that comes to mind is probably the dumbest game purchase I've ever made on eBay, which was probably Final Fantasy III for the Super NES. But I think I paid about $100 US for it, and it didn't come with the map. It was like one of those things where it was like mint condition and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, man, I really scored it. I paid $100 for it, and then I get it, and there's no map in it. And I was like, wow, that's not mint condition at all. And I just got screwed.
You bought it for collecting purposes.
Yeah. So that's probably the dumbest one.
I didn't even remember that game came with a map. I mean, you don't really need it.
Yeah,
that much.
I'm pretty sure it did.
Okay, yeah. Well, a lot of RPGs did back then.
Mm-hmm. Zelda, didn't Link to the Past come with a map? I mean, did you need that?
Oh, man, did it?
It came out with a big fold-out. I had the North American version because I imported it. It's this big fold-out thing that had a map on it, but also had a bunch of tips and, you know, like art and all. It wasn't just a map, but again, yeah, it was just this thing to do with those kinds of games. Like Earthbound came with all sorts of crazy crap, like scratch and sniff rubbish. And, you know, like, it was just a done thing with RPGs. Like, you have to give people added value to get them to play them in the West, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, I didn't need it to play the game. I just kind of wanted it when I was paying $100 for the freaking cartridge.
Yeah, fair enough, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking of Link to the Past, I mean, I bought that game for myself, but I remember when the game was announced in Nintendo Power, basically from the day that I saw it in Nintendo Power until it actually came out, I called the toy store every day when I got home from school to ask them if they had it. Because I had Nintendo Power at the time, but Nintendo Power didn't really have a release date for it, and the store didn't know when it was going to come out, so, you know, I just called them every day for probably 3-4 months, and they must have hated me. Like, at the time, I had no sense of how annoying I was being. But, I mean, it just didn't seem like there was any better way to do it at the time. I didn't have that much information about games at my fingertips, and so, you know, my conduit to what was coming out was to call the store and ask them if they had it yet. And they'd say, no, it's
funny thing. Funny thing I know about this situation is that someone at that toy store was friends with Al Gore, and that's why he invented the internet.
It would have been around that time, actually. Oh, you've solved the mystery. So, I think I have an answer for this question. You know, it's been a long time since anyone gave me video games for a gift, because, you know, my friends and family know better at this point. But when I was a kid, my parents actually, I mean, I'm sure it was usually my mom, but my parents did actually go buy games for us, because we didn't really know what was out there. You know, we would ask, they knew we, you know, my sister and I, we wanted video games, especially me. And my parents knew that I would want something, but they didn't know anything about games. They didn't play games, but they would go, and I think they would ask employees, what's a good game for my son? He likes this one, he likes this one. And I didn't know what to ask for. I didn't know what was coming out. I didn't know what was available. So I remember on a number of occasions, my parents would come home with a video game. I mean, this was usually, you know, for my birthday or around Christmas. It was very unusual that they would just come home randomly with a video game. I don't, you know, that didn't happen that much. But I remember games like Mylan Secret Castle, Centipede, Star Tropics. Oh boy, there were a number of mainly NES games. That would have been the era when this happened, but quite a few of those games, you know, I got for gifts not knowing anything about them, which is really exciting when you're a kid. I mean, at any time when someone gives you a game that you've never heard of before and you put it in there and you don't know what it's going to be like, that's really exciting, and that's an experience I haven't had in a very long time.
Yeah, it's like you almost know too much now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I definitely had the same experiences when I was growing up. I think my parents got me Faxanadu, which is a really great 2D kind of Castlevania-ish game. Got Cobra Triangle, which is a really good action-y boat shooter. Yeah, there's a lot of games. I have no idea how they thought to get those games. I certainly didn't know anything about them when I got them. I think the only game I knew about before I got was maybe Kid Icarus. So yeah, I mean that is an experience that is kind of unparalleled these days in the age of internet.
Well, I was lucky because I was a younger sibling, so I had an older brother to protect me from terrible games and to do all the good ones.
Yeah, and this would happen a lot with the rental scenario too. My family was always big into renting movies and stuff, and once we found out you could rent video games, you know, my mom would make a rental movie store run and would come back with an NES game for my sister and I that she thought we would both like, and it would be stuff like Zelda 2, Bump and Jump. I don't know if you guys have ever even heard of that, but
no, I've heard of that.
Wizards and Warriors. I mean, she would just find something that she knew we had not had before. She'd try to get something new that we hadn't played yet, but it could be anything. You know, sometimes they were terrible, a lot of times they were great, and that's how I experienced a lot of games back in that time, was just kind of luck of the draw or my mom's weird intuition. I remember the time Mom came home with Tetris, which she bought for us, and given the amount of time that she herself played that after that, I have a feeling that she probably heard from one of her friends about this crazy, awesome puzzle game called Tetris, and she probably bought it for herself, but, you know, kind of said it was for us. I don't know.
You know, yeah, absolutely. My dad bought Tetris for himself for Christmas. It was the only video game he bought. He was the only NES game, at least, that was technically his in our big pile of NES games.
Yeah, but the only time I remember getting a game as a gift that I hated, I didn't hate it, I couldn't use it. I remember one Christmas, my parents bought me a Turbo. They knew I wanted like a controller with Turbo, which, you know,
it's a recipe for disaster.
NES Max.
A controller.
I probably wanted the, what was it? It wasn't the NES Max, because that was the giant joystick platform, right?
The wasn't the Max the one with the like the kind of the circular pad?
Yeah, that's the one I wanted. Yeah, you're thinking of the NES Advantage is the big arcade style.
The
one.
Advantage was the giant thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they have in Ghostbusters 2 with Statue of Liberty.
Yes, exactly.
You are an 80s repository, an 80s movie repository, Greg.
That's the one you can play with your feet. But anyway, I wanted the NES Max, the one with the circular thing, and it had turbo buttons on it. And my parents, they just made an honest mistake at the store, and they brought home a different controller for me. So imagine little Johnny on Christmas morning opening up a present, and there's a TurboGrafx controller wrapped up under the tree, and I looked at it and I was like, I don't know what this is, but I cannot use it.
Yeah,
and he had to take it back and return it and get something different, which was probably the NES Max, which I'd probably played at my friend's house.
I was afraid you were going to say you got a TurboTouch 360. That's also unusable, more or less.
Excuse me, I bought a TurboTouch 360 for my Super NES.
Really?
The one with the touchpad thing, it does not work very well. At the time, I was having problems where, you know, I was getting blisters on my thumbs from playing Super Nintendo games too much, and I thought, oh, this is great. You know, you can play it, it just reads your touch, but it's a really old school bad touchpad. It just doesn't, and it's not a touch screen, it's a touchpad. And it just did not respond properly, and it was very hard to use. Very, very hard to use. So I did have one, though. I used it occasionally on my Super Nintendo.
See, I figured you would get one of those terrible third-party controllers that was just absolutely ass.
No, it's weird. My parents didn't know shit about video games, but they always seemed to bring home something that was at least okay, like Centipede. Or it wasn't Centipede, it was Millipede for NES.
You know what that is? That's the Nintendo seal of quality, that is. this is where the Atari era went wrong, because if they were doing it in the Atari era, the dollars to donuts, they were bringing up shit.
Yeah, but they, you know, by luck or intuition or maybe just good advice from people at the store, they usually brought home really good stuff. So I was very lucky in that. Anyway, time to move on. I think John's reading the next question.
All right, Sergeant Foster writes, some say, in parentheses, Nintendo haters / lovers from IGN, if Nintendo supported a trophy achievement system like Sony and Microsoft do, then they would have a reason to dust off their system and play it again. I believe that this is complete BS. It is not just a trophy system that'll do it. It's the actual online community. It's the ease of befriending people that you've played against and with. It's seeing what friends are doing when my system is on, and it's the ease of purchasing games in an online store that's easy to navigate and on which I'm able to filter my searches. Look at what Facebook and MySpace have done to games. We need social networking in everything we do, or we just feel lonely. My Wii is a great family experience, but my wife doesn't want to play the conduit with me or compare Metroid completion stats or get all nostalgic with how far I can get in Pokemon Snap. Can you imagine an online two-player with some of the titles on the VC? How much cheddar would they bank off being able to easily spend $5 for an NES game and then message your friend that you got it and that you'll smoke their high score?
Ooh, well, okay, so there's a few different things here. I guess the two main questions are about some kind of a trophy achievement system, mm-hmm. and then the you know, the idea of online multiplayer in virtual console titles. So let's look at the first one first, the trophy achievement system. It's been talked about a lot recently. Craig Harris at IGN kind of wrote this editorial saying why Nintendo needs to add achievements, especially for their next system. I'm not sure what the value is of doing it retroactively on Wii, but whatever the next console is, he really feels like Nintendo needs to catch up with everybody else on that. And then James Charlton sort of wrote a response on the Nintendo World Report blog saying that, you know, it doesn't need to be what Craig, he kind of agreed with Craig, but not in the spirit of it, but not in the execution. And James Charlton was saying that it should be tied in with Club Nintendo and stuff like that, so you can kind of earn points online that then you could actually use, which would be an improvement over the way that Sony and Microsoft do it, where it's just completely arbitrary. It's just for showing off. So I don't know. What do you all think about this?
Well, I think Sergeant Foster's kind of right in the sense that if it is just arbitrary, if it's meaningless, if it doesn't link into Club Nintendo stuff or, you know, accrue some sort of more tangible kind of reward like what James was talking about, then it is meaningless without the social integration kind of aspect, because that's what it's all about. It's like, you know, comparing. You know, in itself, it kind of means nothing. But then when it's relative to someone else, then all of a sudden that arbitrary thing actually takes, or may take on, at least for some people, some sort of
meaning.
Well,
John, I bet you remember this, John, that back in the day, you could meet certain achievement kind of requirements on Atari 2600 games, take a picture of it, send it to Atari, and they would send you a badge, like a real cloth badge that you could sew on your backpack or something.
Indeed, indeed.
And that was kind of the first achievement system. And it's interesting because it is more like what James Charlton wants with the Club Nintendo thing, that, you know, you do certain things in your games and you get something physical in return. And maybe it's just a knickknack, but at least it's something, you know. And Atari innovated on that a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lot of patches?
I did not have a lot of patches, but I remember I actually did send in a screenshot of Pitfall. And I believe I might have actually gotten a patch for that.
And David Crane rewarded you with a boy in his blob.
Yeah.
Just for you. John's in the special thanks.
Actually, the blob is based on John.
Oh, Lindemann, that's
his child.
I mean, at the time, I was a pudgy little kid. I'll admit it. I'm not afraid.
I was referring more to the afraid. Shiny sheen.
But at the time, I was strangely easy to command.
Malleable.
Give him candy, he'll do whatever you want.
Go over there and make me a lot of toots.
And look pretty while you're doing it.
Yes. Oh, the movie Secretary, also based on John Lindemann.
Yeah. I have seen that movie, Johnny. I have seen it.
Would you rather be James Bader or Maggie Gyllenhaal?
I don't know. That's for another podcast, I would say.
It depends on how much you like being in Crash, I suppose.
I'd rather be James Spader in Stargate, man, the chick he ended up with. All right, so...
Well, it seems pretty clear that Nintendo won't just put achievements in, mainly because they've come out and said they don't just copy their competitors. In fact, they intentionally avoid copying their competitors, regardless of the quality of what their competitors have.
They've kind of
done
it a little bit with the Metroid Prime tokens and the stamps in Wii Sports Resort and stuff, but of course that's the thing. Again, they're just kind of arbitrary kind of stuff. I guess. Well, you buy like bonus stuff in Metroid Prime, so at least I guess there's that, but you know, at the end of the day, they don't really amount to very much in themselves, and then when they're not part of a unified system that everyone's
exactly
locked into, that they can compare online very easily, it's just kind of meaningless. That's where Sergeant Foster's absolutely right. If you haven't got that integration, it is, no pun intended, token.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the way the current Xbox system works, the Xbox Live system, there's basically two functions of achievements. One of them is to get you to play the game in ways you may not have thought of playing the game.
That's the best.
And the
function.
Other is to keep track of your progress on the entire library across the system. And I actually find the second part a lot more interesting than the first part. I like to kind of just look at my score and see it kind of crawl slowly towards higher numbers and think about all the hours I've wasted playing NCAA football.
the meta game of gaming.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I really think that the thing in like Metroid Prime 3 and Metroid Prime Trilogy, the achievements they've added there focuses more on the first part of that, which is try to get you to do things you may not have otherwise done, and that doesn't really interest me at all. You need to have some sort of unified system for the appeal, at least for me, for the appeal to be there.
I care much more about the first thing, Andy. I think achievements are great for getting you to explore the game, and what I like about them is that, you know, I mean, you've already bought the game, so, you know, you tend to think of game developers as kind of cynical bastards who just want you to buy it, and then once you buy it, you don't really care anymore. But what I love about achievements is that it shows that they've thought about how someone may or may not actually play the game that they've purchased, and it helps you when they're done really well, and certainly in a lot of cases they're not. But when achievements are done really well, they're mapped out, they're laid out in interesting ways, you get them at a good pace, and you kind of care about it, They get you to try things that you wouldn't normally try, and they get you to explore and appreciate your game.
Yeah.
In a deeper way.
Return to it, really.
Yeah. And, I mean, it makes sense in a way on the developer or the publisher's part, because if you are exploring every facet of that game, I mean, the longer that you play the game, the more invested you become in trying all of these different things that are there for you to try, the less likely you are to trade it in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the ways they keep you from just playing through it in 5 hours and trading it back in for $30 store credit.
Well, I mean, some people tend to kind of hate on achievements like it's a big dick waving contest or something like that. But I mean, I've never really been one to dismiss extra content, which is what it is. I mean, you don't have to do anything with them if you don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, it's take it or leave it. I mean, you know, I've played most of my PS3 games, so I don't really care about trophies, but I'm not going to begrudge their presence other than, I suppose, I mean, there's talk about what they do with Heavy Rain, is they're going to defer the little alerts because that could break the narrative. I could see that problem, but, you know, as long as you can stop that from happening.
There's plenty of precedent for that. I mean, in Beatles Rock Band, you don't get achievements until the song is over.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas in
as long as there's nothing silly, like where it actually would interfere with the game, then it's totally a take it or leave it thing. I mean, I think, in terms of what Nintendo's done so far, I mean, I don't really think the stuff they put in Wii Sports and Metroid was all that successful in terms of getting you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do.
I thought they were fairly standard achievements.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you get tokens for collecting artifacts in Metroid Prime, which you have to do to finish the game. I mean, you know, it's stuff like that. I mean, you know, obviously there's always certain amount of trophies and achievements like that that are just, you know, sort of signposts on the way to the end of the game. But
it would make more sense that they gave you a token for sequence breaking, for instance.
That's a really cool idea. Yeah,
like that's something that you can do in Metroid, but most people would never think to even try it. But if you look at that achievement there, you say, oh, well, I wonder how you do that. And then you start playing it a different way. And
they've acknowledged sequence breaking in the past. There's a bit in Fusion where if you break the sequence, the computer has a chat with some shadowy person about the fact that you've broken the sequence of the game. So like, it's not as if sequence breaking is like a see no evil, hear no evil thing within Nintendo.
They're very, very... I mean, they actually plan it out. I mean, they do a good bit of debugging to keep you from doing it in a destructive way, but they also build in avenues that allow you to do it in a harmless way.
Yeah, which is good, because it helps replay.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's great. I mean, the hardcore Metroid fans love that.
I actually have a lot more interest in the later parts of Sergeant Foster's email, such as the Facebook and MySpace comment. If you look at the MySpace, if you look at the Facebook integration that Xbox Live just added, you know, I have no interest in looking at Twitter and Facebook for my Xbox, but one of the things it did do is allow you to link your Facebook and Xbox Live accounts, which allows you to find people you are MySpace or the Facebook friends with that also have an Xbox Live accounts. And I think that's really cool. That's a feature that is...
That's the one useful thing about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a feature that's vastly overdue, is to the ability to take these social networks that you're a part of and sort of, I don't know, allow you to use the benefits of one in the other. And Nintendo could certainly use something like that. I know I don't see them partnering with any other company, especially like Facebook.
Well, but, the first thing is you've got to get the online network, you know, just for Wii or its successor right first, haven't you? I mean, until you haven't got a unified username, a gamer tag, whatever, it's just a non-starter, really, isn't it? You know, the full friend code thing. But once you get to that point, like Xbox has, then it's just a case of, you know, how do we get people to sort of disseminate their gamertag as widely as possible, I guess, and then linking it into a really popular social network makes plenty of sense. I mean, I guess the interesting point about it is that Nintendo seems to have this very standoffish approach to online, and yet you might think, you know, the way that the kind of casual gamers or whatever you want to call them, you know, people are sort of not that interested in gaming, but they've picked up a Wii or whatever, you know, they probably are into Facebook, so you would think there'd be some complementarity there, and yet Nintendo are basically not in any position to exploit that because their online network is so underdeveloped at this point.
I mean, I was even surprised that and this is kind of telling, I think, is I got an email a couple of weeks ago, and it mentioned that Nintendo has a Twitter account. And I was actually surprised at that.
Yeah.
Like, I was amazed. I was like, wow, they actually have a Twitter account. That's how forward thinking of them.
Yeah, but they're just going to do, like, press release headlines on it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And so, you know, of course, you know, I subscribe to their Twitter feed, and it's the most vanilla Twitter feed ever. Like, what kind of Nintendo DS game did you get over the holidays? Reply.
Right.
It's like not even interesting. I mean, it is. I mean, I would like to see stuff from them, like, you know,
Major Nelson.
Yeah, exactly. Like some sort of inside stuff. I mean, I don't think I subscribe to him, so I don't know how good his Twitter feed is. But, you know, kind of like blog style stuff.
It's clearly a person behind it. It's clearly a guy who plays video games. He talks about non-Microsoft products from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
He gives out deals. Like, he does free Xbox Live codes like once a week or so, where he just gives away games. I mean, Major Nelson's Twitter feed is really a pretty great example of what the kind of benefits of that kind of community.
And it's totally corporate. It's not like he's doing this on the dirties, you know.
Yeah.
It's, oh, he's that's totally part of his job is to do Twitter, but he does it well. Whereas Nintendo, right. Yeah, they're gonna do it Nintendo Week style.
Well, the thing is, I just feel like Nintendo has dropped the ball sort of in this console generation is that they've kind of become faceless. Like they've, I mean, Sony has a blog, and Nintendo just really has nothing like that. Nothing that. It's like
point.
It's kind of like there's really nothing to communicate with their hardcore fan base. I hate to use the word hardcore because it's not really,
yeah.
You know, it's not really what I'm getting at. But you know what I mean? Like the real diehard Nintendo fans, they really don't have any kind of outlet like that to follow. Like if you're a diehard, you know, PS3 fan, well,
us.
You can follow Sony's blog. It's,
yeah, totally,
absolutely.
And I mean, it brings up an interesting contrast. I think you make a great point, John. And what Nintendo has done is actually harness social media in a very different way. Whereas instead of there being a corporate voice from on high who's using these media like Facebook and Twitter in the most cynical way possible, which is just to disseminate corporate interests.
Yeah.
Instead, what they've done is, and I give them a lot of credit. They did this very early back in 2006. You know, one of the major factors behind the Wii's incredible success mainstream is that they did things like harness the blogosphere, which is,
yeah,
I hate that word,
quote unquote mommy bloggers.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of casual gaming stuff, a lot of just really super mainstream social media like that. So, and of course they did very heavy placement on the Today Show and Conan O'Brien and everything else under the sun. So, I mean, they, you know, you couldn't miss it in whatever form of entertainment or news that you chose, you were going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But they did actually make very, very clever use of social media early on. They just didn't, you know, it wasn't from the Nintendo corporate blog. What they did was they just went out to blogs that already existed, that already had devoted followings. And they said, try this, tell people what you think, which is really the way that it should be done.
Mm-hmm.
Although at this point it's become such a standard that the FCC stepped in and said, well, you have to make certain disclosures about this. But I mean, Nintendo was really a pioneer in that front of how to use blogs and other things like Facebook for word of mouth. And that's the thing. I mean,
yeah.
Major Nelson doesn't create word of mouth. Major Nelson is the word of Microsoft.
The mouth of Sauron.
and it's just interesting when John says Nintendo's become this kind of faceless corporation in this generation. I think that's probably what they were going for, because they don't want to have a face. They want everyone to be the face of
it's
Nintendo.
It's bottom up, not top down,
right? And they're, yeah, you have to give them credit for that strategy. I think it has paid off for them quite a bit, but it is noticeably different from what the other companies are doing. I'd say more successful too.
Well, I think the problem with it is that they've kind of overshot their diehard fans. So their diehard fans really have nobody talking to them.
They've definitely left out a certain segment,
yeah.
And that would be us. But, you know, hey, I figured that, you know, we can step in and fill that void as Radio Free Nintendo. But the other thing I wanted to mention, and we'd get angry letters if we didn't say anything about this, is that Nintendo actually has started working with Facebook, not on
DSi.
Wii, but on DSi. This development didn't get a whole lot of press when it actually took place. They announced it at E3, and like a month later, you had Facebook integration with DSi, so you take photos with the shitty built-in cameras and put them up on your Facebook album. And I haven't used it myself. I understand it's just very straightforward, no frills kind of a thing, but it does work. And if the DSi had decent cameras on it, I might be interested in, you know, using it for that and going and getting a DSi for that purpose, just because it's so simple. I mean, that's basically what iPhone does, and that's a huge part of iPhone is you take pictures and they're on Facebook 30 seconds later, and you know, DSi can cool. do that. It's a great feature. It hasn't been all that well publicized, and maybe it's just because the camera quality is so poor. But I think it shows you the direction that they're moving in, and I think there's a lot of potential for, you know, growing on that foundation. And maybe you do get into, you know, whatever the next console is. Maybe the friend system for that is just Facebook. You mm-hmm. know, they just work out a deal. They've got that ground. They've got the foundation already laid out, and maybe you don't even have a gamer tag for Wii HD. You just use your name. Facebook.
That's brilliant.
Bam.
That would be brilliant.
The only people who can add you as a friend on your system are people who you've already approved on this outside service, which is, I mean, sure, back in 2006 when Wii came out, Facebook was a big mm-hmm. question mark. You know, it existed, but it wasn't nearly what it, I mean, now it's just a social institution. So
it also absolves them of the liability that they would face running into, you know, legal problems with, you know, the whole child predator thing that mm-hmm. they've cited as one of the reasons they don't want to get too comfy with the online space. You know, if they just go through Facebook, that kind of absolves them of that liability because it's not their network.
You're kind of piggybacking onto their protection architecture.
Yeah, I mean, you could have something like either like a Facebook app that you can add to your Facebook account, or just a checkbox saying, you know, saying allow this person to friend me with their Nintendo console.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Very good.
Which is, you know, pretty much the polar opposite of where we are now, where we've got, you know, bank codes for each game. Mm-hmm. So, the one thing I would say is that, you know, mate, it is something where, you know, you see how successful just these little games are, is what Sergeant Foster's talking, these little games on Facebook itself and all this sort of stuff. It's your rich potential. You know, for someone to really tap into. And in many ways, you know, Nintendo's inclusivity would suggest that it's somewhat well-positioned. So if they can, maybe that will be the one thing that could actually drive them to pull their finger out with the online stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks for the great questions there. And thanks for listening. Welcome to 2010. Andy, appreciate you being on the show, man. Thanks for filling in.
No problem.
And we will look forward to having James back next week. And until then, you can rate and review us on iTunes. Actually, I'm glad Greg mentioned it last week. We don't talk about this too much, but we've had a lot of new listeners on the show in the past few months. If you have not gone to iTunes and given us a little bit of a review, click on the stars, you know, whatever you feel like we deserve, we would really appreciate that. iTunes is actually one of the prime ways that we bring in new listeners, and new listeners are great for us. You know, we don't make any money doing the show or the website for that matter, but what it does is it just helps us to reach more and more people. It brings in more questions from the audience, which gives us new ideas on things to cover. And you know, any kind of feedback you can give to us, whether it's email, TalkBack, iTunes, whatever, it all helps us make the show better. So we would really appreciate you taking the time to do that. And thanks to everybody who's already done it. Some of you years ago, some of you have done it long ago, and I definitely want to appreciate that. So, all right, I think that's going to do it. Until next week, we'll see you later.
Later.
Later. Bye-bye. All things considered, if High Voltage being a developer that hadn't really done much in that genre, and whoa, my animals are freaking out. Okay, edit that out.